ball.
I asked everybody. I said, who wants the ball? And he said, give me the MF ball. And I said, all right, you're getting it. And I said, don't mess around. Go after it and do it. And I give him a lot of credit, man. The big dog came up and threw.
Kevin Willard after the game last night talking about what he asked everyone in the huddle. And Derek Queen said, give me the MF ball. But, you know, Derek Queen afterwards in the press conference said that he'd never hit a game winner before. And Kevin Willard said, now you tell me. I wouldn't have given you the last shot if I had known that. Big time moment for Maryland basketball. There's so much wrapped up into it. They've been on the wrong side of those so many times, not just this year, but over the years. Painful losses. Getting out of the first weekend for the first time in 9 years, just the second time in the last 21 years is really crucial for them. Just a really thrilling win. 301-230-0980. Phone lines are open. How far can they go? And anything else you have on yesterday's game? Denton, what did I miss?
Well, so I'm going to harp again on the Queen shot. I thought it was insane. You know, we had talked about early in the season when he was first starting to play, how people were describing that his game was very similar to that of Nikola Jokic. And that's a big comparison. It's a three-time MVP. But that shot at the end was very Jokic-esque in that unorthodox, but he was able to make it work. Righty going to his left off glass, despite the fact he didn't really have an angle for it. I thought that was sensational. I really do think that despite the fact that I agree with you in that they should have used a foul late in the game and they did not, I did think it was very brilliant that they knew exactly, all right, inbound the ball, push the ball, then call timeout to not force themselves to have to go the length of the court. Because that length, you got to go the length of the court with a to win the game is going to be an incredibly tough thing to do. So I really love the way they handled after the buzzer beater. It sucks that they've had to deal with a lot of the buzzer beaters, but they did look like a team that understood not panicking when a guy hit a three late in the game where they only had a couple of seconds left. So I thought that was really, really brilliant. I think as you look forward and you have Florida on the horizon, you got to make it a very, very key point of the offense that you have to feed Derek Queen and Julian Reese much more frequently to start the game. I thought they settled a little bit too much at the beginning of the game for deep shots. You got to get Derek Queen and Juju Reese involved early. I think they can hang with Florida. You know, I know that line, it's 6.5 now. It actually opened at 7.5, Kevin. So that line has moved a little bit early. Florida's a great team. They played really, really well towards the end against UConn, but they're not a perfect team. Maryland hasn't played their best game of the tournament yet, I hope. So I think they can keep it tight with Florida.
I do, too. I think that we've been talking about this for a couple of months now. Maryland has been for, you know, really once they got everything going, you know, late January-ish, it was obvious that their starting five was really good and capable of winning, you know, several games in March. And Florida's really good because they've done the same thing. I don't think Florida probably feels like they've played their best game yet in the tournament. I know Maryland hasn't played their best game. You know, Maryland had a game against Illinois in the quarterfinal round of the Big Ten tournament. That's what they're capable of. I mean, literally being uncheckable and explosive to the point where they're unstoppable with certain players on the floor. Real quickly, too, because I didn't mention this in my game take, I was so excited for the game that Deshaun Harris-Smith had on Friday night against Grand Canyon. Off the bench, 11 points. He knocked down a three. Yesterday, he had a wide-open three and hit nothing, and that was really hard to watch. And then, I don't know, did he hurt? He acted as if he had hurt something. You know, a lot of us understand, especially usually it happens when you miss a layup. It's like, damn. I rolled my ankle. You start hobbling back down.
He was
court.
Really grabbing his wrist after that shot, though. They never gave us a replay to see
they didn't
if his
give
hand
us a replay.
Got hit.
They did
I
not
did
give
think
us a
he was really good, though, not in the shooting element of it, but the high pick and roll. I do think he has good vision and understands where the pass needs to be delivered. So there was a couple of those plays that I thought
he did
well.
And he is an excellent defender. There's no doubt about that. All right, phone lines open. Your chance to weigh in on Maryland's win over Colorado State. Let's start with Chris in D.C. Chris, go ahead.
Hey, good morning. How are you doing today?
Good, Chris.
Man, I'm excited. I'm going to tell you why I'm excited, because when I picked my bracket, first and foremost, my coworker is a Florida grad, and he know everything about Florida, and I pick his brain all day. And I'm just going to let you know like this. I picked Maryland to play Duke in the final when I started. It looks crazy, but I was like, hey, if Maryland could stay away from athletic teams, because Maryland lack of the ability to give up a lot of offensive rebounds. And Florida is one of those teams that on their miss, they get 36% of their missed shots, offensive rebounds.
Yeah.
But I just look at this game. This game is going to be exciting because, you know, Florida, they got their three guards all seniors, and all three of them are transfer guards. And Maryland have three guards. And the matchup that I'm looking for is Gillespie versus Clayton. Gillespie played a heck of a I think he had four steals in the last game. And his defense intensity and Miguel, I would love to see Miguel play Clayton, because Miguel is a hell of a defensive player. And I think Maryland really have a chance because their bigs is going to be the key. You know, Florida is tall, but they're really light. We got to come into the game and feed. You got to feed your big man early in the game. Florida shot, what, 34 free throws last weekend? Maryland don't foul. The reason
they
why
missed
I believe
a bunch
Maryland,
of free throws. Maryland missed 12 Friday, yeah. But Florida missed a bunch in that game against UConn.
Yeah, Florida missed 12 as well. But I just
was it 12?
The reason why Maryland give up so many offensive rebounds because they play a 7-8 man lineup, so they don't play too aggressive in the first half, and then they're a great second half team. And a lot of people talk about Florida going to run Maryland out, but Florida is not that deep of a team either. You know, you look at it, they're really similar as a team. If you go look at it, guard plays, points per game.
No, they're very similar. They got bigs. They got guards. You mentioned it. I think it's Miguel on Clayton. And I think Maryland will mix up their defenses a bunch against Florida. But to me, Miguel against Clayton Jr. is the matchup you want. Miguel is a physical, you know, man. You know, he's an older, developed, mature dude. He hit some shots down the stretch, Clayton Jr. did in that game that were incredible. I mean, he was guarded, and he knocked him down.
I got one more question for you.
Yeah, quickly.
I got one more question for you. All right, check this out. Maybe I'm fine crazy, but I really think that Queen will be a better pro than Flag because of his ability to. Like, I think he's going to really develop a consistent three-point shot. He have that frame that he's going to be 6'10", 6'11". And I believe he'll be a better pro than Flag. I know it might sound crazy, but time will tell.
Look, he is a skilled big guy. That's what you need. Thanks for the call, Chris. Is that, you know, typically the freshmen that come out that are projected lottery picks, they're physical specimens. They're super athletic. That's not him. He's not unathletic, but he's not explosive athletic. His true calling is his vision, his IQ, his feel for the game, his handle. He's a phenomenal passing big man. He really is. Like Kevin Willard said at one point during the season, he said, if he were white and Euro, he'd be the number one pick in the draft. The truth is about Queen, though, his game does resemble sort of Euro style, but he hasn't stretched the floor as a four, which is what he's going to play in the NBA. He's going to play the four spot, but he can. And I've been saying it all year. He's got a good stroke. I think he'll develop into a good 3-point shooter. You know, there's some Karl Anthony Towns in his game in terms of you know, his ability to sort of be in control with the basketball. You know, moving his feel, his floaters, his vision is. It's terrific. I'd like to see him move a little quicker defensively and be a little bit tougher and more physical consistently on the glass. Ian, go ahead. Is Ian there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Yeah,
Do you have me?
I got you now.
So to answer your question, I think they lose to Florida because I think they're just a different level than Grand Canyon and Colorado State. But everything you said, I agree with. This is such a huge win. The only thing you forgot to add, this is the first Sweet 16 in Kevin Willard's 18-year career. I mean, that's a huge milestone in and of itself. Maryland's third since 2004, or second, rather, since 2004. Derek Queen was tremendous. And I agree, like, when you have a game that close, you can dissect every foul, every possession, every missed call, every call that went both ways. And I think you're right. I don't think the officiating was great, but I think it was even both ways. If that game's played 10 times, maybe Maryland wins six of them. It seemed very even. The one comment I want to say is, again, for Willard to do that, and we went back and forth over DM on that in that press conference, and then to turn around and make it seem like it's the media's fault or somebody else, put a huge spotlight on that team, and for him and the team to deliver was huge. Because if not,
well, the media comments his sense of humor. It's his sarcasm. You knew that, right?
A little bit. But
yeah, he's very sarcastic. Was calculated, and
right,
you
it
know,
was.
Yeah.
And the thing is, again, he knows when he does that what's happening. To basically, I can't think of another coach outing the departure of his boss openly while also trying to leverage a new contract. Like, that is quite a power play. And with the Sweet 16, he delivered. Without it, it would be a complete different narrative. And it just shows you how
close it would be for the fans. It would be for the fans. But those that know understand how the last two coaches, him and Mark, have had a battle that I don't think they should face at what I believe should be a basketball school. And it's been a constant battle, constant walls put up. And he used that situation, the Villanova situation, the 25 wins, the second place finish in the Big Ten, to say, I want to be here, but we got to start treating this like the fans believe it is, which is an elite basketball school, because there's a lot of stuff you guys don't know that is much different than true, you know, top-tier basketball schools. I loved it. I think it's been a lot of, you know, things that we haven't been able to talk about, you know, publicly all the time. But look, it's not over yet. They got to get the right AD. They got to get he's still got to get the right commitment. I haven't said this yet on the show. I think he's staying. I think he's staying, and I want him to stay. And I hope he gets every single thing that he needs to compete at the highest levels of the sport. Go ahead and finish up. I want to get to the other calls.
Yeah, no, I don't disagree with what you said there. And I think there is a lot of truth in that. And I too, like you, follow Maryland pretty closely and understand some of the unique challenges that shouldn't be there. But I would also caution you to say Maryland being a basketball-first school, I think the way the money is in sports now, that even basketball-first schools have become football first schools, whether you saw it with Indiana football this year. Or
I understand that. I get that.
You know, and so
just the rev share alone, there's a certain percentage that has to go to football. So, it's a much higher percentage than basketball. We all understand what's driving the money, but there's just a lot of stuff that at a bare minimum should be something that Maryland's program and basketball department gets that they have to fight too hard for. Let me move on. Thanks for the call. Let's go to DC. DC, thanks for holding. Go ahead.
Kevin, how you doing, man?
What's up, DC?
Last night I was watching the game, and when they hit the three, I was like, the whole game I said that Colorado State not driving to the basket. They living and dying by the three. I thought they were going to miss it. When he made it, I said, oh, man, it's time for us. We got to come up with something amazing. But I don't know what it is about when they come across that half-court line. It's always, like, funny calling a timeout. Like, it's almost like they're about to have a turnover. I was like, yo, somebody else needs to call a timeout other than the person with the ball. Do they allow the coach to call a timeout?
Yeah, final 2 minutes the coach can call the timeout.
It always looks crazy to me. But the first thing I say, all right, we got the time.
By the way, I know exactly what you're talking about. In fact, when you see a team that wants to call a timeout, you want to get the ball over to where you want to inbound after the timeout, sometimes the player is way too casual, and a defender can step up and maybe, you know, make a play before the timeout gets called. Yeah, no, I know what you're talking about.
Yes. So when we got the timeout, I looked at it like this. I said, we're going to penetrate and dish. I was looking for a lob, right? But I seen Queen in the timeout, and he was standing up. Everybody else was saying Queen was standing up. He had that towel in his hand, and he reminded me of John Thompson because he had that serious look on his face. And I'm like, yo, Queen about to take this shot. But I still thought we were going to lob it to him. But when he got it at the top of the key, I said, oh, it's on. Go to the basket. And he went to the basket. He didn't get all the way there. But he threw it off the glass, and that was a perfect shot. Everybody said it was difficult, but I think it was perfect because most defenders are playing for somebody to shoot it straight in. They're not used to people going and shooting it off the glass like that.
Yeah, that was defended pretty well. That was defended pretty well, and he got to that spot, and shooters know this, where it becomes much harder to bank it in because the angle becomes more severe, and you got there's like now you're limited in terms of the spots off the glass, and he hit the spot. He hit the spot.
Yes,
DC, great call, man. Yes, always good to hear from you. 301-230-0980, 301-230-0980, if you want to weigh in. How far can they go, Maryland, and anything else from last night's game? Let's go to Mutu and Frederick. Mutu, go ahead.
Hey, Kevin. Man, I'm looking at this game winner from Queen as just a sign of good things to come. Maybe it's destiny, man. Because we keep hearing about Florida and their three guards, but guess what? They got to deal with our three guards. And when we're making shots from outside, and Queen and the other big man inside, Reese, are doing their thing, we're a tough team to beat, man. So I'm just hoping we go into this game loose, play with desperation, but just play how we normally play when we're rolling. Because if we start making shots, Florida's going to have a problem. My key is Reese and Queen. Queen, I feel, is so advanced for his age, skill-wise.
No doubt.
A big man to have the kind of touch and finesse that he got. But yet, I don't feel we've seen the best of him. And I mean from like a physical aspect. I want to see him imposing his physicality down low. Because he got the size. If we do that, man, and if we beat Florida, Kevin, I think these guys are going to the level of confidence and belief. Man, we could win the whole thing.
Thanks for the call. Thanks, Mutu. Appreciate it. What I'd love to see now that, look, I think this is more of a fan feeling and maybe even a coaching staff and program feeling, but maybe not a player's feeling because they haven't lived through what everybody else has lived through. But I feel like there's like a big weight off the shoulders now. And they can play more loosely and freely. I'm not saying that they played tightly, because I don't think they played tight necessarily. They just didn't play their best yesterday. They didn't play their best on Friday. They won by 32, and they gave up 13 offensive rebounds to Grand Canyon, and they missed 12 free throws in that game. I know what their best looks like, and many of you do as well, you know, going through the course of the season. Some of the games that they were just so impressive in, you know, the Iowa game. Now, Iowa doesn't defend at all. The Illinois game in the tournament was so impressive in that Friday night quarterfinal. The game at Nebraska was a game in which they were really difficult to check. The two wins back-to-back on the road that really got this thing started at Illinois and at Indiana were really impressive games. Those were the games in which, you know, you watched them and you said, wow, they have two bigs, You know, both who, you know, one is a true low block scorer, but actually has developed into a decent pick and roll catch mid-range guy in Reese. They got an all-world freshman at the four. He can, you know, he can take you off the dribble facing you. He can score with his back to the basket. And then they've got an excellent playmaking and scoring point guard with two incredible shooters on the wings, one of whom in Rodney Rice is a big-time shot maker, just not a shooter, but a shot maker. By the way, Miguel is too, to a certain degree. Miguel's range is incredible, but they've had games. I mean, they had a game in December before they really had put it together where they led Ohio State in their first Big Ten game 50-17 at halftime. It was the largest halftime lead in 30 years in the Big Ten. They led by 33 at halftime. In that game, I think at one point they led by 46. They did not play their best yesterday. They didn't play their best Friday. They didn't play their best against Michigan in the semifinals. I actually thought, you know, coming down the stretch, they had a couple of sloppy wins against Michigan on the road and against Northwestern at home. If they play their best, which we've seen 7-8 times, 9 times this year, 10 times this year out of their 27 wins. You know, more than that. You know, 12, 13, half of their wins, you've seen a team that wasn't going to lose to almost anybody other than maybe Duke or Houston, you know, on a given night. If they play their best, they got a shot to win two and get to the Final Four. There is no doubt in my mind. I definitely think they are a team capable of winning at least two more. And when you look at the bracket, you know, their semifinal game would not be Duke or Houston. You know, those two teams are really good. Auburn, Denton, how many times this year have we talked about Auburn and I'm like, they're not Duke. They play so methodically. Even the game against Creighton, they pulled away late. I was glad they did. I had them laying the 8.5. I told you before the bracket came out, I wanted them to be the four, if they were going to be a four, in the bracket with Auburn more than Florida. But I don't know. I could easily see a minimum of two more wins. What about you?
I mean, Florida's going to be the tough one. I think if they get past Florida, the world is their oyster. Because I don't know that if they play their best. And that's a big assumption to assume that they're going to play their best every game the rest of the way. But if they play their best, I don't think there's a lot of teams that can beat them. You know, Florida would be one of them that I think has the firepower. Duke is the other one. But I think the list kind of stops there, especially when you look at the rest of their bracket. If they get past Florida, I would feel very confident.
Would they be favored over Texas Tech?
I think so. If you beat Florida, depending on how they beat Florida, but if you beat Florida, let's just say you beat them by like 6 or so, I think they'd be favored over Texas Tech. I think they should be favored over Texas Tech.
Texas Tech's pretty good.
They are pretty good, but
they're seeded higher. They're a 3 seed.
Yeah.
Look at us. We got them in the Elite Eight. Let's focus on Florida. We'll have somebody on to talk Florida basketball before Thursday. Florida's really, really good. Colorado State, you know, had not lost since like early February. And I thought that team was impressive, like really impressive. I thought they were well coached. I mean, their spacing alone and their movement alone offensively was fun to watch. I think that guy, Neat Clifford, is a pro. Is he a senior? He is a senior, right?
I think regardless, he's going to the NBA next year. Yeah, or at least going to test the waters.
And I thought that was, and turned out to be, I think, a much tougher test than Memphis would have been, in my opinion. But look, Florida is a good basketball team, and they have been rolling. You know, there were a lot of people that picked Florida to win this whole thing before it started. I think Florida and Duke were the two most picked teams, I think, in the draw in the ESPN bracket contest. You know, they're another team. They haven't lost in like a month. I mean, it's been a while since they've lost, and, you know, they've got, like, you know, multiple wins over Alabama recently, a win over Tennessee, they beat Missouri, and then they beat a game UConn defending champion yesterday. That was, you may not like Danny Hurley, and I understand he can be a bit annoying. He's one hell of a coach. All right, some Denton news. next. Ben will join us at 12. We'll get back to college hoops next hour. But Maryland off to the Sweet 16.
Terps are down by one. And Gillespie looks to inbound. There it goes to Queen. Queen will drive in against Morton. Queen with a shot off the glass. Got it! And the Pelicans have won it! At the buzzer on a shot! Oh, my goodness! By Derrick Queen! 72-71, and we're heading to San Francisco! It's about time! Wow! How about that?
Man, oh, man, oh, man.
Johnny and Naki on the call Sunday in Seattle is heard right here on your home for Maryland basketball, the Team 980. The head coach of Maryland is Kevin Willard. He's back with us. All right, take us inside the huddle with 3.7 seconds left. We've heard, you know, your explanation. Did you really just look around and say, who wants to take the last shot?
Yeah, Kev. I mean, sometimes it's interesting, you know, like, I have four guys that have never played in an NCAA tournament game. And, you know, to be in that situation, you know, sometimes you have to read body language. You have to kind of see how guys are playing throughout the whole game. And I just, you know, I told the guys, I said, guys, all right, I'm not losing another buzzer beater. I said, I've had enough. I said, so we have our chance now. I said, we haven't had a chance in the last four games that we've lost because of buzzer beaters. I said, now we're going to, it's our time. And I said, everybody take a deep breath. I said, who wants the ball? And I looked around, and Derek, he just said, give me the M&F ball. And everyone kind of looked at me and kind of said, yep, give him the ball. And I said, all right, let's go out there and do it. Like, no messing around. Let's go out there. And I don't want any of that. Nothing fancy there, big fella. Just go out there and just get a bucket. And he looked at me and said, I got you. And that was it.
If, just hypothetically, if nobody had stepped up, if he hadn't stepped up and said it, what would you have run?
Somebody.
Oh, come on. What was in your mind before he stepped up and said, give me the MF ball?
Well, I have a play card that has, on the back, I have, there's like, it's six scenarios, and they've been the same plays really for the whole year. So I kind of knew that depending on what side of the floor we call timeout on is usually how I'll run a play. And, you know, because I think we were a little bit shocked that the guy made the shot, Selwyn was bringing the ball up on the right side of the floor. So when we call timeout, my original thought process was to give it to Rodney because Rodney's really good going left and taking a step back jumper, which I thought we had plenty of time for. But once Derek said that he wanted it and the way he said it and the way those guys reacted to him, it almost like it gave them the confidence. It was just a no-brainer.
I thought it was funny when he said he had never hit a game winner before. And you said, well, I wouldn't have given you the last shot. But he's still a great option. And by the way, getting him the ball where you got him the ball, we've watched all season long. I mean, him in the middle of the floor at the free throw line or free throw line extended is such a comfortable spot for him.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I knew that they had the transfer from Purdue guarding him. I forget his name, number 25.
Yeah.
And he's a heck of a defender. But at the end of the day, Derek's a legit 7 foot now. And Heidi, I think, is like 6'7". It was just a kind of simple thing. Just try to get downhill, and he's either going to get fouled or he's going to get a good shot at the bucket.
You know, I noticed something about you because I've only watched the play about 100 times at this point. You watched the final possession standing from the very end of your bench, not anywhere near your seat or the coaching box or midcourt. Why that spot, that angle to watch the final play?
I didn't want to. Two reasons. I want to make sure Selton and Derek did what they were supposed to do on the baseline. The play is designed for Selton to go over top of Derek and then Derek to go and then Juju pinned down. So I just wanted to make sure that Selton went over top. And then in that situation, I didn't want to be in Jacoby's way or vision. I just wanted Jacoby to focus on the play. So for me being down there, I was able to help Selton and Derek kind of just in that situation, you know, although we've run that play and they know the play, just to give them a little bit more confidence and guidance.
I want to get to the defensive possession before that in a moment, but after the three by Lake, your team looked very prepared. No timeout. You had one left, but 6.1 seconds left. The ball comes in. Selton takes it across half court, calls your last timeout. Was that an end of game situation that you've practiced?
Yeah, I would. It happened pretty quick, but they took the shot earlier than I thought they did. If they had made that shot with 3 seconds or
you would have called timeout.
I would have called timeout immediately. But you have so many more plays. At least I do. I have so many more plays in my playbook from a half court standpoint than I do a full court. And I think it's easier to defend a team full court than it is in the half court.
Interesting. We are talking to Kevin Willard. So the defensive possession before it, the three from Lake, you had a foul to give. What was the plan defensively? Because you had a huddle. They had called the timeout with 12 seconds.
So we talked about fouling, and really my mistake was, I talked mostly with Rodney and Jacoby because we were going to come out and play zone. We had played zone the prior possession and worked really good. That we got them to call a timeout. We defended their stuff really well. And so I talked mostly to Rodney and Jacoby thinking that the ball come, if they run a zipper play and get the ball up above the 3-point line, we were going to foul. We didn't want to foul below the 3-point line because kids nowadays are so smart that they, if you reach in below, they're going to go up and they're going to try to do the NBA thing and get a foul. So when they went right to the post with on Selton, we didn't want to foul right there. It just below the 3-point line.
Yeah.
Nico has
with Clifford backing him down.
Well, he also has 7,000 underneath out of bounds plays.
Right.
And it's easier to get a three on an underneath out of bounds play than it is on a sideline out of bounds play. So below the 3-point line, if we fouled it, it would have went to an underneath out of bounds play. And I've never seen a guy have more underneath out of bounds play than they had. So that's kind of why we talked about fouling above the 3-point line, but it never got there. They just went right into the post.
God, that is so interesting. Just the idea that the scout is so deep that he's got so many underneath his basket inbounds plays. It's easier to get a three where you lose on a three. And if you foul him there, the ball goes to the baseline as an inbound spot rather than to the sideline. We're talking to Kevin Willard. Real quickly on that last, possession, you had played. Why did you play more zone? In watching you, a lot of your zone turns into man during the possession itself as the shot clock winds down. Sometimes it's a matchup. Why did you play more zone in this game? Was it what were the reasons?
Colorado State, we counted the night we beat Grand Canyon. We watched film that night, and we counted in the game against Memphis, and Memphis did a good job of pressuring them. We counted 32 different sets that they had run, or 32 different options out of their sets. And to try to prepare for all that and do all that, one of the things you can do with zone a little bit is at least it takes them out of their full playbook. And that's why we played a little bit more zone. It wasn't effective, but at least we didn't have to guard all their stuff.
Do you think that one of the things I was going to ask you about specific to not only Sunday, but even Friday against Grand Canyon and certainly the semifinal in the Big Ten tournament against Michigan is the number of offensive rebounds you guys have been giving up? What are the issues that have led to that?
Yeah, I think that's, we talked about that as a team yesterday. We have switched a little bit more than, Michigan makes you switch a little bit more. Obviously Colorado, we had to switch, 1 through 4. And I think a little bit is that we had some bad mismatches on our switches. We have guards, we had guards on Wolf. We had guards on, some of their big right. guys against Colorado State. And it's become a little bit of an issue where it's been bad game planning by me, by getting our guards switched on to some bigger guys. So you know, we can't do that against Florida. Their Florida size is just so big. So we're going to go back to doing a little bit what we did in the beginning of the year and just stay a little bit more at home.
First half of the game Sunday, Neat Clifford, who, by the way, is an incredible player.
He's really good. Yeah.
He threw a blatant elbow that connected with Jordan Geronimo. Why didn't they look at it? When did you find out about it? Take me through that situation.
I told Jordan, I said, man, you gotta lay on the floor a little bit longer. I said, you gotta sell that. I saw it at halftime. Like, you know, again, they didn't review it, which was, we had a really good reffing crew. It was one of the best three guys that you could put on a game. And they came up to me at halftime and said, you know what, we saw it. We missed it. We apologize. And you know what, Kevin, sometimes they just miss stuff. You know, the good thing was, you know, Jordan wasn't hurt, and, you know, it's just one of those plays. Sometimes refs miss stuff, and it's not a big deal.
Yeah, it just was a critical moment because I think it was a 3 or 5 point game. You get 2 free throws on the ball. During the regular season, people probably would have been talking about a flagrant 2, but it more likely than not would have been a flagrant 1. I was just curious as to when you found out and whether or not had the conversation.
The instant replay at home is so much different. You know, you see that stuff automatically. Like,
sure.
You know, our video guys do such a good job at home that after every play, it's up on the Jumbotron. You know, at the NCAA tournament, they don't do that. So you don't get to see it as quickly as you do during the regular season, which is a little bit of a disadvantage.
All right. First time for you in the Sweet 16, first time for the program in 9 years. How do you balance, you know, for your team, the excitement of the finish, of advancing to the Sweet 16, but also not treating it like, you know, Thursday night ends up becoming icing on the cake?
No, I mean, I let them, you know, yesterday was a travel day. You know, we went from, I've been on the West Coast so long, I think I should pay taxes on the West Coast.
You mean you didn't have to bus it home and then hitchhike back out?
No, we traveled to San Fran yesterday, and I gave the guys, yesterday was a rinse day for me. Like, I let them enjoy it. We did a lot of media. The guys did a lot of media. We watched film. We did a walkthrough on Florida. But for the most part, I just gave them yesterday to kind of enjoy the win. I wanted them to embrace it. I want them to, you know, this group has been phenomenal to coach and so much fun to coach. I think you have to celebrate your success. But at the same time today, I told them last night, I'm like, guys, we're getting back up today. And they were all business. You know, they understood it. I think they appreciated the fact that, you know, I didn't grind them yesterday, and I just gave them a day to be kids and enjoy winning a buzzer beater in March Madness.
All right, you know, I got to ask you this. Are you staying at Maryland or going?
Yeah. You know what? Over the last week, I know I've said some things that have raised people's eyes, but, you know, Maryland's been great. We're in a perfect shape. I missed the radio show today, and everybody thinks, I missed the radio show today because I overslept. I'm on West Coast time now. Everything that my concerns have been about the job, and that was my whole point of my press conference, and, you know, maybe my jersey came out of me not in the greatest way, was, you know, I want to make this program the best, and I think when you have an opportunity to do it, you have to take advantage of the opportunity, Kevin. And, you know, obviously losing the athletic director has been a little bit of a, I wouldn't say, it's been a little hard, to be honest with you, just because, you know, I wasn't expecting Damon to leave and go to SMU. But I've been working with Brian Ullman and everyone in the athletic department, and they've been great, and they understood my concerns and what I want. And again, I don't want monumental things. I just want, you know, this program to be the best it can be. And I think I'm not asking for that much.
So are you staying?
As of right now, I'm staying, Kev. Yes.
As of right now, but are you going to get the things that, are you comfortable right now saying that you're going to get the things you need and you are going to be at Maryland as the head coach next year and beyond?
Absolutely. I mean, and I, it's, you know, Brian Ullman has been phenomenal. You know, he's actually the first guy that's come up to me. One of my issues is I just didn't have a great...
Tell everybody who Brian is.
Brian's a... it's the CEO. I'm not sure what his title is. He's in the athletic department, and he's way up there. There's a lot of people up there. Jeff.
Okay, just so everybody knows. Yeah.
But he's been great. He's the first guy that's actually sat down with me, talked to me, and really found out what my concerns and what I really wanted, you know, because it's not a contractual thing for me. It's more of a program thing for me. And Brian and I are on the same page. He has been awesome. He has put a lot of what I've felt over the last 3 years about the program. I think he's finally starting to understand where I want this program to go. And that's all that matters to me. I want this, you know, what Lefty did, what Gary did, what Mark did, what I want to try to do is elevate this program to the best. It's what our fans want. It's what my donors want. They talk about it all the time. It's what I want. It's what my expectations are. And when you're at a place like Maryland, there's just certain things that need to be done to be at the top of college basketball. And I can tell you that I don't know if Brian's trying to get the AD job, but Brian has been phenomenal.
You know, last week, and I think we all talked about it, you know, anybody that does what I do, we talked about your comments. I personally love them for a lot of different reasons. I'm not going to go into them now. And it was some of the jersey and you coming out, which, you know, some of us like. But I'm curious to some of the specifics you mentioned, but were they the biggies? Like right now, the top two or three things that you really need to make Maryland what you want Maryland to be and what people like me want Maryland to be, the ability to compete at the highest levels of the sport, what are those things?
Yeah, I mean, first and foremost, you know, obviously we're you know, the fans don't really understand this, but we're entering into a whole new era of profit sharing, of literally schools paying players. You know, I think the Big Ten and the SEC have done a good job of trying to move away from collectives and donors paying to schools paying. And, you know, with a football program, with a really good women's program, with a phenomenal lacrosse soccer program, you know, I don't want to take away from those programs, but at the same time, in men's basketball, you know, there's schools out there that are going to be able to do things that we can't do. So, I don't want someone telling me, especially since I don't have an athletic director, I don't want someone telling me that we're going to do it. I want to put in my contract. I don't want people making decisions about my program who aren't involved in my program that make decisions that affect my staff's life, my life, but doesn't affect their life. So those are big ones for me because, you know, I live it, breathe it every single day. And again, you know, I want this place to be the best. As you know, this fan base expects that. But it, you know, to be perfectly honest, it hasn't been treated that way for a long time. And my goal is to get it there.
Yeah, I think that's really important what Kevin said for all the Maryland fans listening, because I think the perception from a lot of us and from a lot of the fans is that Maryland is a very high level program, and certainly from a history and tradition standpoint, it's true. But we're in a different era of, you know, of players getting paid. And your answer there specifically was, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, about the share of the revenue that goes to basketball.
Yeah. And I think, you know, again, the funny thing is if you brought any basketball coach on right now that's in the Big Ten, the SEC, Big 12, really, I think those three schools, I think the ACC is a little bit unique because they have a much diversified basketball football mix. But most of all of us are sitting there saying, okay, wait a second. Like, it's nice that you're saying this is what we're getting, but then at the end of the day, are we getting that? And, you know, the transfer portal is crazy. There's kids asking for $2-3 million right now. And the money has exploded crazy because we have no guardrails. We have no rules. It's been as badly implemented of a rule as ever in any sport. And kids or agents are taking advantage of it. You know, every player has an agent. Every agent is calling every school and saying, hey, you know, I got $1.2 million here. Give me $1.4 and we're gone. And, you know, if you don't have this profit share in the rev, you're just not going to be able, to compete. It's just the way it is.
Yeah, and yet you did a phenomenal job last offseason because there were opportunities for some of those players to take more money elsewhere, correct?
Yeah, I mean, I do think, again, and that's kind of where I stand a little bit on the transfer portal. You know, we talked to a bunch of guys yesterday when the portal opened. You know, it's like, all right, we'll be there. We'll be in the same range. But, you know, we also want guys that want to be at Maryland, that want to that fit what we're trying to do, that are still great kids, that have great work ethics, that want to be around the staff, that wants to get you better. So that's still a big part of the sell for me, is that I just don't want to go out there and just say, here's $2 million. And just bring someone in that doesn't fit our culture, that doesn't fit what we're building, that doesn't fit with the guys that we have returning. So it is a big part of that. And the guys that came last year were all into that. They, you know, they wanted to experience what they're experiencing right now. So there is a balance, but unfortunately, agents have really just taken over the sport.
All right. How do you beat Florida Thursday night?
Well, they have a young man named Walter Clayton who is as good a guard as I've seen in a long time. I mean, he's shoots 38% from three and takes almost 50% of them off the dribble, off pick and rolls. You know, we're going to switch up our pick and roll coverage. We have to. We just can't play the way we've been playing. And we have to do a much better job on the glass. We have to do a better job on the defensive glass. And transition defense. They're a really good team. They're ranked second in the country for a reason. It's going to be a great test for us.
Best of luck. Appreciate you doing this. You know how much I enjoy our conversations. Thursday night will be a lot of fun, and I think a lot of people are hoping, and it sounds like it will be the first of your many Sweet 16s and beyond at the University of Maryland.
I appreciate it, Kev. I'm glad I didn't oversleep for you so everyone didn't get in a frenzy.
Appreciate it. I'll talk to you soon. Thanks, Kevin.
Thanks, Kev.
Kevin Willard, everybody, head coach at Maryland. Kevin Sheehan Show, the Team 980, the team980.com, or free and live on the Odyssey app.
Weathers inbounder.
What a basketball game last night at Xfinity Center. The Maryland men played in a game Sunday that produced the best ending in March so far. But the best game so far in March was played last night in College Park. The Maryland women rallying from down 17 in the third quarter to beat Alabama 111-108 in double overtime in the second highest scoring tournament game of all time. Brenda Fries has her Terps once again for the 12th time into the Sweet 16. Would have likely been 13th time had there been a tournament back in 2020. Maryland gets the top seed in the region, the defending national champ South Carolina, on Friday in Birmingham. Tip set for 5 p.m. on ESPN. Coach Brenda Fries joins me right now. You've been around a lot for a while now. You know, last night was your 860th game as a head coach in college. You've been involved, I'm sure, in a lot of memorable games. Where does last night rank?
Oh, well, first of all, I've got to say this weekend was Maryland madness at the highest level for both teams. And you are right. You know, you kind of forget about the body of work and that many games. And clearly, you know, I've been really fortunate to be a part of some special wins, that overtime win and the national championship game. And but this one, you know, ranks right up there. I mean, it had all the feels, the emotions, the highs, the lows, being down 17 to coming back and the double overtime. And just can't say enough about the resiliency of this group.
So let's go to that moment late in the third quarter, 3 minutes to go. You've got 13 minutes left in your season, and you're down by 17, 62-45. What was the message to your team?
You know, just encouragement, trying to, you know, give as much positivity, confidence that, you know, just we didn't have to do it all in one shot and, you know, had to come down to getting a stop, then a score, and understanding just, you know, valuing the possessions and, you know, credit to the resiliency of these kids. I mean, they fought, they battled, they believed, and, you know, just a huge turnaround in that game.
You know, you've done it before. I think you were down 18 to A&M a few years ago and came back. I actually, in watching the game, I thought the final 3 minutes of the quarter, third quarter, were so crucial because you guys cut the lead from 17 to 9. And actually, after a turnover, you had a shot. McLean had a shot, a really good look to cut the lead to 7. I thought that stretch, getting it under 10 before the fourth quarter started, was huge. Did you feel the same way?
I did. And, I mean, like you spoke of, I mean, so many important plays there with Mir McLean, you know, off of the bench. We had Amari DeBerry, who hadn't played at that point and came in the game and gave some impactful minutes. And that's what it's all about in March, you know, being ready when your number's called. And you know, they just strung together a lot of impactful plays.
I mean, as a coach, when you're down by 17, getting it to single digits is a psychological positive, you know, hurdle cleared, isn't it?
It really is. It really is. You got to, you know, find the motivation to get your kids to believe that they can still do it. And I'll say that about this locker room. I mean, they've trusted the process. They've stayed true to it, you know, especially when a lot of people have counted them out this season, especially throughout the injuries. And, you know, it was, you know, kind of fitting to be able to see, you know, them be able to turn it around.
Up 3, coach, at the end of the first overtime, they've got the ball. I think there's six point something seconds left. What was the strategy? I know you didn't want to foul Barker shooting the 3, but was there a plan to foul and put them on the line for 2 before anybody got into a shooting motion?
You know, there wasn't. We haven't been great at that. I think also, like, we haven't, you know, also we've had some issues at the free throw line, boxing out and those kind of things, and or inbounding the ball and you know, within that. So, you know, clearly we thought we could defend the 3 and, you know, the play unfolded as it did, and credit to Sarah and the game she had and to be able to step up in that kind of environment and make all 3 free throws. But again, I thought our group didn't flinch. You know, they went into, you know, the second overtime and clearly believed that they could pull it out. But, you know, no team deserved to lose that game. That was a heavyweight fight and, you know, just 2 elite-level teams going after it.
Yeah, some of the shot-making back and forth at the end of the, you know, during the fourth quarter in the overtimes was amazing. We are talking to Coach Brenda Fries. The Terps are back into the Sweet 16 after just an incredible game in College Park last night. And before I get to the performances of a couple of your players, I've got to ask you about Sarah Ashley Barker going for 45 points, 5 short of the all-time record in an NCAA tournament game. Take us kind of inside some of the conversations you and your staff and the team were having trying to slow her down.
Well, first of all, we had our best defender on her with Mir McLean. You know, Mir actually made her have to work for those 45 points. So those were not an easy 45 points. So to tell you, you know, what that looked like. But, you know, we even, you know, started, you know, when doubling. She had the hot hand, I mean, we started to double and try to get the ball out of her hands and still had a really hard time because she's just that good. I mean, you saw her will to win and her competitive spirit to be able to lead her team on, and really, really talented player and difficult matchup.
Yeah, there were a couple times I'm like, I could see you're running double teams at her, and they're still, she was making plays. I was actually going to ask you, is it ridiculous to say, you know, Sarah Ashley Barker went for 45, but she also turned the ball over 11 times?
Yeah, she did. She did. And you know, having those turnovers were, you know, possessions for us to be able to go down and get shots at the basket. So, you know, you kind of pick your poison a little bit. But, yeah, I mean, we were able to do some things defensively to be able to force those 11 turnovers that were really helpful.
I mean, it was a team effort overall. I mean, you had some really good defensive plays when you needed them in the comeback. But Sellers and Tibiasu, clutch performances by both. What makes them so good in moments like last night?
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, your guard play has to show up. And yeah, like you talked about, those two, Kaylee, Michael, I mean, massive plays. And you saw the confidence level. They wanted the big moments, you know, this time of year every team can play, and you can't shy away from them. You have to embrace the moments, and you saw that. I mean, a big play after play with Sarah on both ends of the floor, last play of the game defensively, big threes and scoring when we needed to put the ball in her hands. And then what a fitting way, you know, both being seniors, Shy Sellers' last home game and her four-year career here at Maryland in front of our fans. So I just couldn't be happier, you know, for both of them, for Shy and her journey, and to be able to, you know, lead this team now onto the Sweet 16.
I thought, you know, just watching on television, and I've been in that building when it's been crazy for men's games, but I thought the crowd really, really helped, you know, in the comeback in particular, as you guys started to cut into that lead. How much of a factor was playing that game at home last night?
I mean, huge. That's why you work all season. Sure. To be able to have that as sixth man, and they were a massive influence. I mean, they impacted that game, the energy level that we needed to have, especially with the minutes that our players had to play in a 50-minute game. I mean, you know, both Sarah and Allie didn't come off the court, two of your five starters, and, you know, just that additional energy was, you know, huge for us to be able to pull it out. It's the reason why we're top 10 in the attendance every year, and we have the greatest fans in the country.
Yeah, it was a great crowd last night. You know, you mentioned just the minutes. Tibiasu played 50. Kubek played 49 minutes. I mean, it didn't seem like at any moment. I thought if Alabama, and I thought in particular Ashley Barker, really started to look a bit exhausted at the end. But for a game that just had the pace to it, and then, you know, the 10 additional minutes of two overtimes, it didn't really look, watching it, like fatigue was a major issue with your team.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, they didn't show it. I'll say that. I could,
okay,
you know, see the fatigue in Alabama. You know, I thought we were able to use our timeouts wisely when we did see it, coming into play. But, yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, they did a phenomenal job, you know, digging deep to be able to, you know, last through the 50 minutes.
Two of the best coaches in the game go at it in the Sweet 16 in Birmingham, Dawn Staley and Brenda Fries. They are the defending champs. You played a great Elite Eight game against them 2 years ago. Talk about the challenge. What do you need to do to pull it off on Friday?
Yeah, you know, I mean, obviously they present a lot of problems. They are really deep, you know, they go 9 or 10 deep. I mean, their two leading scorers are off the bench, if that tells you anything, out of their rotation. They're always, you know, lead level defenders, get out in transition. They're hard on the glass. They rebound extremely well. But look, every team at this point in this stage of the game, Sweet 16 can play, and so you're going to have to come out, and we're going to have another game as good as this one, you know, in order to have a chance, and you know, that's all you can ask for. I know our kids are fired up; they're motivated, they're driven, and we're going to go give it our best shot.
What makes Dawn Staley so successful as a head coach?
Yeah, you know, that level of consistency year in and year out. I mean, she gets her players to buy in. I mean, there's not a lot of programs where your top two scorers would be happy to be coming off the bench. So she finds a way to keep their morale and, you know, through all the, you know, 10 All-Americans she has, she's able to, you know, keep them intact. And that's not an easy thing to do nowadays. And, you know, just does a phenomenal job with her group.
Do you know her well? Who are your close friends in coaching?
Yeah. No, Dawn and I know each other extremely well, all the way back to her days. You know, we kind of came up at the same era, you know, when we played but, you know, I mean, you know, closer friends, Tina Langley, you know, was on my staff. She's in the Big Ten now at the University of Washington. Our Big Ten coaches are, you know, a really connected group. Chrissy Curry last night at Alabama. I mean, she's someone from the days when I was at Ball State as a first-time head coach. She was at Purdue and someone I really looked up to and someone who, you know, I've spent a lot of time talking to within the game. So Tricia Cullip at Miami, you could go on and on. But, you know, a lot of great coaches that support one another.
You are certainly one of them. Your run at Maryland's been truly amazing. I'm curious, and I've probably asked you this before in recent years, but how has the current era of NIL and transfer portal been for you? What are the challenges?
A lot of challenges, but, you know, you adapt. I think you can see with the roster that we currently have, you know, Sarah Tibiasu, Sailor Poffenberger, Christina Dulcey, Mir, Amari DeBerry, you know, a lot of players we were able to get out of the portal last year to help us be successful this season. So, you know, it's here to stay. I think our staff has really found what works for us. You know, the portal actually opens today. Great timing, right? When you're
Why
trying to get
that?
Ready for a Sweet 16 game. I wish I knew. You know, it should start after the you know, Final Four finishes. But, you know, I don't make the rules. They don't ask me. And now here we are juggling both. You know, we're not only, you know, getting together today to work on our scout, we're also working through where our calls need to go in the transfer portal. So, the busiest time of the year, but I'm not complaining. I'll get sleep when the season ends and, you know, looking forward to seeing, what lies ahead.
Did you know that this was the first time since you've been at Maryland where both the men and the women have been in the Sweet 16 at the first, at the same time?
You know, when they told me that last night, I was really surprised, but then when I thought about it in my 23 years, it made sense, but yeah, I mean,
you've been there a lot. It's been the men that haven't held up their end of the bargain.
I'm really happy for the men. I know how hard their staff works, their support staff, their players, you know, you couldn't ask for a greater group. And I'm really, really happy for our university and our state. I mean, such exciting times and the support that we've been given, you know, within our administration and all the way down from the president and the governor, you know, has been to many of our games this year. Our president comes often. So our administration is there at every game. So I can't say enough. It's pretty cool to be able to have on this national stage to, you know, be, you know, one of only four schools that has, I mean, think about that, one of all the 300 plus schools, only one of four schools to have their men's and women's team in the Sweet 16. That's pretty special.
You know, for you, the Sweet 16's become a regular thing, and you've won a national championship. You've been to multiple Final Fours. How do you balance sort of the excitement of last night and advancing to the second weekend, the Sweet 16, especially for players that perhaps are doing it for the first time, how do you balance kind of the excitement of all of that with, hey, guys, this is not the end here. This is just the beginning. The goal is to win the whole thing. Is that a tough thing? Because college sports are interesting. There's a lot of celebration for Sweet 16, for making the Final Four. It's odd that way that college sports, sometimes making the Final Four is as big as winning it all. How do you balance that?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it is a big thing. It's really hard to do. So, you know, of the 300-plus teams, it should be celebrated. And I think you have those moments. You know, last night I took it in with my family as well. You know, I wasn't, you know, going to start scouting until today. You give yourself that moment for our players. They'll get an extra day with their day off today, and we'll worry about it as a staff of the scouting that we've got to get done. But you know, it's easy to get them to lock back in when you get back together, and quick turnaround for us. We leave tomorrow, and you get together and you watch film, and you know, they know what's at stake. So you come down from that high, and you're ready to go do it again.
Brenda Freeze looking to take the Terps to what would be her eighth Elite Eight. If they can pull off the win Friday against the top seed in the Birmingham region, South Carolina. Thanks for doing this, as always. Best of luck on Friday. Take care.
All right. Thanks so much. Go Terps.
Yep, go Terps. Brenda Freeze, everybody. What a run. I mean, Denton. She is at Maryland. 605 wins. 168 losses. All right, so a 783 win percentage. Her record in the Big Ten is 159-34, an 824 win percentage. You know, there were new players. The portal, you know, means you got to coach them up differently each year, a whole new group, and they're back into the Sweet 16, and she's trying to get to her eighth. It would be her eighth Elite Eight. At Maryland, powerhouse program, Hall of Fame coach. And really, when you think about it in our area, and I can only speak to sort of the major sports, somebody will, I mean, I know John Tillman's had a phenomenal run as Maryland's lacrosse coach, and there may be examples of a gymnastics coach or something else at another local school, but locally, professionally, and in college, nobody has had the current amazing run that Brenda's had at Maryland. Nobody in town. Not even close, right? 23 years? That many wins?
Nah,
am I missing somebody?
Of the major sports, I can't think of anybody.
Yeah. All right, we'll do some Denton news when we come back. John Fanta from Fox will join us at 11. Kevin Willard scheduled to join us at 11:25. It's the Kevin Sheehan Show on the Team 980, the team980.com. We're free and live on the Odyssey app. Mackenzie Gore against Wheeler today, opening day, Nats Park, 4:05, first pitch. Against the Phillies, and Bob Carpenter will start his final season as the lead voice of the Nationals on Masson. He joins us right now. What are you going to do this time next year? You just gonna you play a lot of golf?
I'm going to be listening to you on the radio, and it'll be the first time in about 20 years that you and I haven't visited on opening day. Kevin, I think you're the one guy who's called me every year on opening day, and it's become sort of a tradition for you and me. So I don't know. Maybe I'll have to tune in and see who you have on next year.
Well, I can still have you on next year. We can still talk, even though you're not calling the game. Yes, I have had you on every single year opening day, and I've had you on at other various times during the course of the year. And I find one of the reasons I love having you on is sometimes we end up talking about a lot more than just the Nationals. And I don't know that everybody knows this about you, but you were long established as an outstanding play-by-play voice in multiple sports before you came to Washington to start calling Nats games. And I'm wondering, over your 40-plus year career as a play-by-play announcer, Why do you think, what's been the thing that has been most appealing about the way you've called games, in your opinion? I'm not asking you to self-promote, but there are a couple of things that I've always enjoyed about you, and I'm wondering if you have a sense of why you've been able to relate all of these years and do it well.
Well, my sister got a job with the Cardinals when I was 14 years old, so I got to hang around the ballpark. I had tickets. I used to go out in the lobby after the game just so I could see the players come up the stairs from downstairs and exit the ballpark. And so, you know, Kevin, I've been around professional athletes for a long time, and I think that maybe helped me have a sense of, hey, they're people too. They're not gods. You don't get on your knees and worship these guys. They're hardworking, talented young men. And I think maybe that's helped me over the years kind of have an even keel perspective on the different things I've done. And I always wanted to be a baseball announcer once I realized I was not going to be the next great left fielder for the Cardinals at 5'10 and 148 pounds with no power and a little bit of speed. And I always thought, wow, broadcasting would be that'd be a great next best thing. So I know that some producers at ESPN verbalized this to me over my 17 years there, that whatever the sport, they always knew they could trust me and they could count on me to be prepared. And I always wanted to be the best prepared guy out there, because I knew there were guys who had deeper voices and maybe more dynamic personalities than I had. But I always wanted to be the hardest working guy. And I think I told myself that way, way back when I was coming out of school, that maybe that was one way I could separate myself from the pack. And Kevin, it's just mind-boggling to me that I've gotten to do Division I basketball for 40 years. I did two World Cups, including five games here at RFK back in 94 when the city was on fire for soccer. And I'll tell you, when Italy played Mexico, this town was crazy for a couple of days. I'll never forget that. You know, and I got to do six or seven college football bowl games back when it meant something to do a bowl game, because there weren't that many, and some NCAA basketball tournaments, and obviously the baseball. So I grew up a well-rounded sports fan, not just one sport. I loved hockey. I was a teenager when the Blues were born in St. Louis, although I've only done a handful of minor league games way back when for my local cable system in Tulsa. So I just think maybe getting to know all different sports and approaching them with a good work ethic. And the other thing is, I was on a Zoom call with a bunch of students last night up at Joe Yashiroff's department up at the University of Maryland. And, I told them the way you treat people on the way is important too, because Kevin, you know this, kids who were production assistants and pulling cables when I started at ESPN in 1988, they're now producers and they're directors and they're executive producers. They remember it if you treat them well. And I think it's a lesson for us, no matter what business we're in or what walk of life we're in, that, the way you treat people, I think, helps you in the long run, too. Because if it comes down between you and another person, they might say, hey, that's a really good guy. Let's go for him.
So I wrote down a couple of things, because if you didn't mention them, I was going to mention them. The first thing you said, and I wrote this down, I'm like, in listening to you call games, and I've told you this before, I can remember being in my apartment in College Park Towers on Hartwick Road, for those of you College Park people. I didn't live in the one on Knox. I lived in the one on Hartwick, watching ESPN college basketball games with Bob Carpenter on the call. That's when I was first introduced to Bob Carpenter. But over the years, you are always prepared, which obviously speaks to work ethic. I also think you've had a very conversational way about you in the way you've called games. And there's something you can't teach, and I think you'll understand what I'm saying. Some people are likable and some aren't, and I think you've had that ability to be very likable over the years. And part of that is your conversational approach, style to it. But you're going to be missed, you got one more year. We'll have plenty of times to have these discussions, including maybe before your final call. But I was thinking about having this conversation with you, and those were the things that I wrote down in terms of why you've been had the run you've had.
Well, I appreciate that, Kevin. That's very nice of you. And here's another thing. you know, it's not that hard to be nice to everybody. And some days are better than others. You know, some days I'm in a better mood than other days, as we all are. And this crossed my mind a number of years ago when I was getting out of the my car at the ballpark one day. You know, some things were going on, and it just wasn't one of those great days. But I'm doing a major league ball game that night. So when I got out of the car, I kind of kicked myself, not literally, in the rear end. But I said to myself, you know what? Right now, you're getting out of your car in Lot A at Nationals Park. There are 100 young people out there who are getting out of their cars at minor league ballparks, college ballparks, high school ballparks, JUCO ballparks. Some of them are just PA announcers getting out of their cars, and they're excited about the game they're going to. Don't you dare ever take for granted what you have, because there are a lot of people out there who would trade, you know, anything to do 1 year of Major League Baseball, and here I am at 4 o'clock today about to embark on my 42nd year. It boggles my mind. I have no idea why I've been so fortunate. You know, some of the stuff we talked about before. But, you know, Kev, in this business, and I've seen this with a lot of guys who are really, really talented, it is so easy to get wrapped up in yourself. And I think our Nationals fans know, for me, yeah, it's about working with Franny. It's about working with Dan, you know, and being around the guys and all that. But I'm not a guy who tries to hang around the clubhouse all the time and be buddy-buddy with all the players. I love those guys, you know, but they have their own little inner sanctum there. And I'm not a guy who goes and sits in the manager's office for 30 or 45 minutes every day. My number one obligation when I go on the air is to make our fans feel good about being a Washington Nationals fan. And some night when we have a walk-off homer, it's pretty easy to do that. Other times when you're getting your brains beat out 8-0 in the fourth inning, that's when you find out if you can pull this off. So my number one priority is always how we are relating to our fans, and nothing in the next 6 months is going to change that for me.
You know, part of what you said reminds me of something that my father told me: treat normal people like superstars and superstars like normal people. And it sounds like that is been part of your MO over the years. All right, let's talk
about... And one more thing, Kevin.
Yeah.
My dad, he was a coal miner when he was a young man, and he and my mom, his would-be wife, were dating. And my mom told him, she said, "I'm not marrying you until you get out of the coal mines." So he went and trained himself to be a welder, and he worked on barges and towboats for 40 years on the Mississippi River in South St. Louis. Two summers of college, he made me put on the hard hat, the steel-toed shoes, the long blue work shirt, the blue jeans and everything, working in St. Louis summers down at that shipyard. I never, ever wanted to go back to school so bad in my life. Yeah. In some instances, I wanted summer to be over so I could go back to school. But my point is that instilled a work ethic in me.
Sure.
And, you know, maybe someone of privilege hasn't, you know, experience that the way they grew up. But, you know, we grew up with what I would consider lower middle class in a working person's neighborhood. And, you know, we play ball morning, noon, and night. The toughest part of the day was mom calling us in to quit playing ball and come in for dinner. And, you know, those values my dad instilled in me long, long ago have stayed with me to this day.
We're talking to longtime Nats voice on Masson, play-by-play voice and face, Bob Carpenter. All right, let's talk a little baseball. What needs to go right for this team to, let's just say, on September 1st, be legitimately in a wild card race?
Young pitching, followed by young pitching. Because I think CJ and James Wood and Dylan Cruz and Luis Garcia, hopefully Kay Barrett, you know, shows us what he can do. And then you got the veterans mixed in. You know, I think the team offensively will be better than last year. We were second from last in home runs to the White
right.
Sox in all of baseball. Not that home runs are everything, because to me, I abide by the old Tony La Russa axiom that extra base hits, whatever they are the important thing. And doubles are one of the most important things in baseball. If you have a team that can drive the ball, doubles, triples here and there with the speed guys, and, you know, some home runs, you got a chance. And, you know, the Nats, I think, scored the fewest runs other than Miami in the National League, and the Marlins have their own set of problems. So I think the offense is definitely going to be better. The defense has to be better, Kevin, second worst to Miami in the National League last year. And the first half of the season seemed to be acceptable, but then after that, there were just some defensive things that did not go well. But these young pitchers, did a couple of them sneak up on people last year? Are they for real? Those are the questions we have to ask. And so, you know, McKenzie gets the call today. He's got to be the leader. He's a young veteran guy now. Still a young kid, still a pup. But, he's got some veteran traits to him. Jake Irvin on Saturday, you know, and then you've got Mitchell Parker and Michael Soroka, who I visited with in Florida last week, so impressed with him, and Trevor Williams. We'll see what he contributes, and he's going to be a guy who's a leader, too. It's just really, really sad that DJ Hers is not able to answer the call here because he might have completed that young bunch. And then the bullpen, I think, is going to be great. I told Kyle Finnegan, I am the happiest guy in D.C. that you are back because I don't like calling blown saves in the top or the bottom of the ninth inning. And hopefully the bullpen will be good, some really good arms out there. But, you know, Kevin, it's going to boil down to the young pitching, airtight defense. And if you can do that, you can win games. Because Whitey Herzog used to say, I can wait for offense. I cannot wait for defense. It's got to be there every day. And when you have a young pitching staff, you better play good defense.
Are you confident that Mackenzie Gore is on the verge or is capable of becoming a true ace?
I think he's got that capability. I listen closely to the baseball people. I believe them before I believe myself because they're the experts. And when they tell me the electric stuff this kid has and catchers who have caught him and, you know, hitters and sim games and, you know, live BP and stuff like that who've had to step in against him. I mean, when those guys say things, you listen to it, and his stuff is serious. And I just think he needs to get over that, maybe that little mental hump. Maybe it's not a little one. It's still, you know, maybe a big thing for him. Don't let a walk. Don't let an error behind you, make your inning fall apart. And when he figures it out, he's going to be really, really good. Bob Gibson once told me, when you're a young pitcher, you know where you want the ball to go. You just don't know how to get it to go there until you've been around the block a few times. And if a guy like Bob Gibson struggled with control, as did Nolan Ryan and some other young guys early in their career, not comparing McKenzie to Hall of Famers at this point, but he's a young guy with a ton of potential, and when he gets his command, look out.
If I told you that we were having a conversation in October and the Nats had a much better season offensively than maybe most predicted, where did it come from?
Well, it's going to come from James Wood. It's going to come from CJ getting on base. Jacob Young, with his speed, getting on base. You know, his defense, unquestioned. It's going to be great. And then, you know, James Wood. I mean, you put a kid like that who's still basically nearly a rookie in the number three hole, that's a pretty big deal. And then veteran leadership, and we got to have pop from Josh Bell. So glad that Josh is back here. Nathaniel Lowe, you know, we need him to do what he did with the Rangers 2 years ago. And, you sprinkle in some of those guys. So, but it's going to be the young guys and the young guys who can run getting on base. Dylan Cruz is a key part of that, and then let some of those big boppers drive them in. And I'm not so sure that at some point this season we won't see Robert Hassel III coming off a great spring. But, you know, young guys with speed getting on base, veterans who know how to do that, driving in runs. Because I remember Tony Perez when he was part of that big red machine. He said, I have one job, and that's to drive in runs. I don't care what my batting average is, home runs, whatever. My number one job is to drive in runs, and that's what those veteran guys have to do.
Bob, as always, thanks so much. Enjoy today. I'm sure we'll talk again soon. On the call today at 4:05, Gore and Wheeler. Appreciate it, as always.
Thanks, buddy. And if I'm not on a tee box or a green somewhere on this day next year, we'll do it again if you want to.
We will do it again. But if you are, I will totally understand. And we can record it the night before.
Okay.
Thanks, Bob.
Sounds good. All
appreciate
right, buddy.
It.
Thanks for having me on.
Yep. Bob Carpenter, everybody. The Nats, 71-91 a year ago. And they're over under on wins this year, right in that same ballpark. So we'll see. They need, as he's mentioned, a lot of the pitching to come through, a lot of the bullpen to come through, but they need more scoring for sure as well. James Wood, Dylan Cruz, Jacob Young, etc. CJ, you know, potentially a 30 home run guy, Wood 25 plus. They're going to need a lot of that. It would be nice to have a competitive team into the latter months of the summer, heading into the fall for the first time in a while. All right, we will get back to Maryland. We will talk some hoops, not just coaching situation. Give you guys a chance to weigh in on the Maryland situation as well. Kevin Sheehan Show, the Team 980 and the Team980.com.